During the recording of this episode, we had some technical issues, so we apologise for the reduced audio quality in some places. But we'll be back next week, where we think we have our first ever episode without any technical issues at all. Imagine.
Hello, and welcome to Preprints in Motion. This is the only show bringing you the freshest science directly from the hottest new scientists. So join us as we discuss science, preprints, and academia. So hit that subscribe button and join us every first and third Wednesday for a brand new episode, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. But for now, let's get into the show. This week we chat to Dr. Kaan Aztikin about his recent paper, Secreted Inhibitors Drive the Loss of Regeneration Competence in Xenopus Limbs. Thank you for joining us. Emma and John might want to mute themselves. There we go. Thank you. See, we're very, very well worked out on how this works. We're professional here.
Well, this is my first time talking to a podcast, so I'm going to be the one who's nervous here.
This is also the first show we're doing where this isn't like my background. So I've had a bit of background for the previous show. So this is, I'm also nervous for this one. We can be nervous. We can be nervous together.
Okay.
This is also the first paper that was previously a preprint we've had on, which is, I'm excited about that. So lots of firsts.
Well, I think it's a very good initiative. Like, I mean, congratulations for setting it up. I think the community can benefit from it a lot. Like, I generally listen to these kind of podcasts a lot during my travel to different countries or like to school even. So I hope like this would be somewhat helpful to someone.
Good. That's what we aim for. So we ask all of our guests to kind of give us a fun fact, ideally something that is not lab based, so we can get a feel for who they are. And I got to ask about yours, because so yours was based around StarCraft, and we're not gamers here, so we had to do a little bit of Googling. But Emma tells me that actions per minute is, for a high level player, is about 200, and yours is 180. Now, you're going to have to explain what those are, but how do you find the time to do that?
The StarCraft takes like 30 minutes to 1 hour to get play, like in a day. Okay. So like if I have time, I do it to kind of relieve stress. Like I need some game that is gonna completely puzzle my mind. Like I am only gonna be able to concentrate on one place, and StarCraft is perfect for that purpose, because that action per minute means like how many buttons you are pressing in every second. Like it just counts it. And like you basically have to press three different keyboards or like keys or like mouse. It's 1 second. Like, so it's really intense strategy game. And I like it.
That sounds stressful.
Some people think that, but I enjoy it. So,
So building on from acronyms, there's a lot of acronyms in this paper that people might not be familiar with. So I guess to start, could you just give a brief background of regeneration in a very general sense?
All right. So the regeneration is the process where we see the lost structures or organs are growing back, and they are taking their before amputation shape, morphology, and function. And the regeneration is a very well-known topic, like the first observation that we know of made by Aristotle. Like, you know, years and years and years ago, he is the first person who realize the lizards can regrow their lost tails, for example. And of course, over the years, we learned it's not just lizards, there are many more animals that can regrow different appendages, such as they like limbs, tails, digits, and the list goes on and on. But for a very long time, we were investigating regeneration by looking at tissues, and tissues are composites, basically populations. And we didn't exactly know what kind of cell types are preparing and making these tissues.
So my knowledge of regeneration is kind of based around wounds. So my background's kind of immunology, wound healing. So with a wound, you get these cells that form where the amputation has been, for example, and those cells eventually lead to a blastema formation, which is where you get your stem cells coming through, and that's eventually how you get a new limb, right? But my understanding was that those epidermal cells, they're called AERs. Could you explain what AERs are?
Yeah, I think before that, maybe I should introduce another topic. Like whenever we have a limb amputation, these animals actually first cover their amputation point with a simple epithelium. And then this simple epithelium becomes specialized, and we call it specialized wound epidermis. And when specialized wound epidermis forms, it sends many different signals to the underlying tissue to form the stem cell or progenitor cell pool that is called blastema, as you mentioned. So this specialized uniforms actually have been quite heavily investigated in the last 40 years. And we have like very big papers in the field suggesting higher vertebrates cannot regenerate because they don't form specialized uniforms, but they form a scar tissue. So it's some sort of the first critical stage of regeneration before blastema formation. And without it, blastema would not form as regeneration falls apart. And very basically, like in salamander research, people have been calling this specialized uniform as apical epithelial cap, AEC, so another acronym. But this AEC has been associated with AER, apical epidermal ridge of limb development that is very heavily investigated in animals, such as chicken or mouse. So we were for a very long time thinking maybe AEC is equivalent to the AER, but we didn't have a very unbiased, high throughput characterization of these populations to completely determine their similarity. So in our work, this was actually our first question, whether AER is AEC, how similar they are. And we were trying to figure that out by using single-cell RNA sequencing and investigating Xenacus. They were staphylococci. They are the larval stages of frogs, and they have a very clear AER during limb development, and they have a very clear AEC during their limb regeneration. And by conducting single cell and comparing, we determined that they are extremely identical, like very similar. And there are only slight differences in their gene expression levels for same genes, for example.
So you started off in vivo, which I imagine, I mean, how easy is that to work with tadpoles and frogs? Because the, I imagine these need quite a bit of space.
Oh, the space is not a problem, actually. Huh. Like they are, the tadpoles are really easy to handle. Like they, all they need is just water that you just change once in a while. And the food is like, you know, you can find in any pet shop almost, so it's easy. But as you just said, like, you know, working with tadpoles or in vivo is generally very, very challenging. And I was extremely frustrated with it. Like, and because like these animals are really mobile, they like swimming, and they are like, you know, we have to keep them in 3-liter tanks. If you want to do drug screening, there's no way you can do drug screening with 3-liter tanks unless you create a huge economical problem for your life. And there are other like problems with Xenopus, like that is actually making our job hard to do experimentation. Like they develop very asynchronously. If you have 100 embryos fertilized at the same time, in a month time, some of them will have limbs, some won't. So they develop really asynchronously, and it's really hard to set a controlled experiment. So I was really frustrated, and I started thinking, like, why don't I try to simplify the system? And like, because we are in an era where we see explants and organoids are basically used to discover like new findings in biology and in regeneration, like especially limb regeneration, we don't have such simplified systems that are robust enough. And in the literature, of course, there were people, like there were some reports suggesting they tried doing some explants, but in our hands, they didn't work, like at least very efficiently for us to do a lot of experiments in a robust manner. But one of the protocols, which we cited in our paper as well, that was showing some promise, but by manipulating the whole media conditions further, like we established a robustly working culture condition where we can investigate the early stages of regeneration in a dish. And I should also mention these, we call them explants. We take them out of the animal by basically first sacrificing animals and then cutting the limb in two different places. Generally, we can say ankle and the knee, for example, and then take that middle piece and culture them. Specific media, and then they start showing the signs of the in vivo regeneration. But this is only recapitulating the early stages of regeneration.
How much tissue do you need for that? Is it like a whole leg, or just need like a little bit of a knee?
No, a little bit of it is enough, but these arms are already very small, so you don't actually have a lot of places to cut and then manipulate. But they fit in 9-6 valve plates, to give an idea how small they are.
Okay. So you could do quite a few at once, kind of high throughput.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a very robust method, not just because of how efficient it is showing the regeneration ability, but it's also very easy to do. And I think if you want to scale up and do many experiments, you don't have time to deal with every individual sample for like hours. You want something quick and reliable. And in that sense, the exponents are really, really great. And I think like it is a game changer for our field, because we can now do like live imaging, we can do drug screens, we can perturb the tissue the ways that we wouldn't actually be able to do in vivo research. Like animals are limited, but here we don't have the whole animal at once.
I mean, and that's kind of what you were doing in this paper, right? You were treating the samples with different things to see what was happening. And one of the things you found was that something that is released from the bone cell progenitors actually limits this growth. So could you expand on that a little bit?
So for the regeneration to happen, the animals have to form AER cells. We know this, and when there's no regeneration, the AER cells don't form, and we think there's a causal link between them, sorry for English. And in Xenopus, we have one more advantage, actually. The older these animals get, they become progressively regeneration incompetent. So we can study both regeneration competence and incompetence in the same animal. And we were wondering why the incompetents are incompetent. Like, what is going different with them? Why they are not able to form AER cells and they are regeneration incompetent? And there are like different hypotheses in the field. Like one of the very famous ones is the immune system develops at the same period. The immune system blocks somehow specialized in the epidermis formation. There's another hypothesis related to the intrinsic properties of cells that are basically cells are becoming incompetent to participate in regeneration. But all these hypotheses were either not able to explain all the phenotypes we see in the literature or some of the our own experiments. So we were thinking what else could be the problem. And in that way, the explants actually gave us a very new perspective. When we get the explant, we have distal and proximal site. Like we can think like, you know, it has two sites, but only one site was able to form AER cell, but not the other site. And I was really actually confused, and I had other experiments which was again, they were really confusing. And at the end, I just realized the proximal site where there's no AER cell, there were a lot of bone progenitor cells there. And then the question became, maybe the bone progenitors are somehow blocking AER cell formation. And we had a lot of experiments to dissect out which signaling pathways are important for AER cells to form. And thinking like maybe bone is secreting something became an idea. And then we checked the single cell RNA sequencing result. It was very clear bone progenitors express very high levels of factors that would block AER cell formation. But how are we going to test this hypothesis? This is a very, very challenging hypothesis test. Like we are saying bone secreted factors are blocking AER formation, hence regeneration, but we cannot get secreted factors from one animal and then transfer it to another one. But at least, like I haven't been able to find any way, and so far the people that I talked to. But we thought explants might be the one way to address this critical question. Like, I think it would be a stringent test for the hypothesis, at least with the available tools we have. So what we did was like we co-cultured regeneration incompetent and competent things in the same bone. The idea was the incompetent would secrete factors that would maybe influence the competent one's behavior. And indeed, this was the case. Like we realized whenever we do such co-cultures, AER cell formation was getting problematic for the regeneration competent explants, directly suggesting secreted factors from incompetent is countering the AER cell formation. And then we, of course, there could be many different factors that are secreting in the incompetent one, such as the immune system cells might be secreting something. So, but one of the key morphogens we thought could be Nogin, because we knew from the literature Nogin is a gene when we overexpress regeneration status. And in our data set, Nogin was very specifically expressed from bone progenitors in a very, very high level. So by removing Nogin from the media and doing this co-culture experiment, we realized that it can actually rescue the inhibitory effect of secreted factors, suggesting the bone progenitors are very likely the reason blocking AER formation. We have some other experiments directing us the same way, but I think that was the key experiment in the paper.
So, I mean, is this potentially linked to patterning? So I guess if you're developing a new limb, you want to develop the fleshy part, and then the bone might perhaps come a little bit behind that. And so is that why you may be seeing that kind of negative feedback?
I'm not sure. I think the patterning part happens much later than the generation calls. Like it's like much later, like blastema has to form, etc. But in our work, we specifically focused on the very early stages of regeneration. So I think our results are not able to say anything about it.
Okay. So this is something that we see in amphibians, but we don't have this as grown adults, but we do have the same kind of systems in the womb. I guess my question is quite simply, how far away are we from me being able to chop my arm off and regrow one? Because currently I'm getting all my tattoos on schedule around my body so that they're all on one arm, because I don't want to lose them all if I lose my arm. How far away are we from that?
Okay, that's a good reason for doing some anticipation. It's the first time I'm hearing someone is asking for this. So I don't know is the right answer, but I am optimistic. Because, like, I mean, for example, if he asked, like, do you know Dolly? Dolly, the first cloned animal, right? Like, I mean, a lot of people would know. But what is the first cloned animal? It is frogs. Oh. And they are cloned in 1962. And Dolly cloned in 1996. So, and it's a field that there is not much, like, need for cloning. Like, meanwhile, regeneration field is a lot more, you know, appealing. There is a potential. So, and we know the science is advancing much faster compared to those days. So I think we are in the right time to advance in that direction, like, you know, what is really going on with mammals and humans. But I think it's still very hard to predict a specific date. All I can say, one thing though, I think we have been, like we need more and more, I think, cell-centric studies. That's my personal view. Like how cells actually move around, like how they decide to do differentiation or proliferation, and then how we are building the whole web. Like we know which genes are fundamentally required, but what these genes are doing to cells, so cells are acting the right way to give rise to a three-dimensional structure. I think we have a long way to go to address questions in that part.
I mean, that is the harder question though, right? It's the genes are kind of the easy bit almost now, I guess.
Yeah. I think we need to fill the gap between tissue observations and gene level observations by putting the cells in the middle. And I think we are in the right era for that. With, as I mentioned, there are more and more simplified systems for different developmental processes that is enabling us to do very good quality, high content live imaging, as well as we have a very expanding toolkit to do different molecular perturbations and different gene editing. So we need to really start bridging these two levels of observation by placing the cells in the center. That's my personal view.
So is this where your interest in organoids stems from then? Because Emma does a lot of organoid type stuff.
I wouldn't say a lot. My lab has organoids. Yeah, I currently don't work on them.
I think there's a very big excitement with it. And I mean, more and more we are seeing very different perspectives, new insights are emerging from organoids. But beyond all of this, I mean, it's opening the doors for studying human development, because most of these protocols can be adjusted to human embryonic stem cells or human tissues, like derived from in vivo samples. So that's why I'm excited about it. But of course, like whatever we find in with organoids, it would first show, like, you know, what cells can do, which is amazing by itself. But we, of course, need to check, like, what is going on in real animals in the nature.
Yeah. I love a good organoid paper. The microscopy is just, it's beautiful. It makes me very jealous every time.
Can I ask one question? This may be a really silly question, but like your explants, could you treat each organoid like that? And then you can treat it with your various factors and see how it regenerates in. Is that like a plan, or is that something?
It is a plan, but I mean, I think we need to first figure out like how we can extend the time period they can grow in culture. Right now, it's very limited. Like we have projects underway to address that question. I think in the future we will see how things will go.
Because it'd be really interesting. Because in our lab, we make midbrain organoids. And so obviously looking at Parkinson's disease, but it would be quite interesting if any factors would actually regenerate any dopaminergic neurons after some loss. That would be, it'd be really cool.
So this is all kind of around limb regeneration, but obviously something else we are quite concerned with particularly as the population increasingly gets towards an aging population, are things like heart regeneration and repair, especially after things like a heart attack or a stroke, for example. So how does what you're doing relate to that aspect of things? Is this something that relates to different organs or different species?
Yeah, absolutely. The latter you said. I think regeneration is an umbrella name. If you say diseases, it could be Alzheimer's disease or cancer. But they are not the same, although they may use some same genes, for different purposes. So regeneration is an umbrella name. Tail regeneration is even different than limb regeneration. And we were thinking these two might be at least more similar. And when you go to heart regeneration or planetary body regeneration, I get asked a lot about these kind of questions, like how similar is limb regeneration to this type of regeneration? And my short answer is, like, if you're looking at genes, you may find similarities. If you look at tissues, like morphology, you may find some similarities. But if you're looking at cell types and how cells are moving around and doing what they have to do, it looks like they are very, very different. And with more single cell-based studies, we are uncovering this context dependency in more detail.
Oh, welcome to the world of immunology. Everything is cell-driven, and a cell can do basically everything in immunology does everything else. It just no surprises anymore. But that's what you get.
I think it's good news because, for example, species you mentioned, like we even know, like salamander limb regeneration, there are differences between Xenopus limb regeneration. So there is more than one way to regenerate a structure. So there could be more than one way to use these findings for therapy.
Okay, so moving on a little bit, you did your PhD in the Gordon Lab at Cambridge. I think you might be the only person I've met who've worked with a Nobel laureate. How was that? Was that intense? Was he chill?
So, if I start talking about John, it can last for hours and hours. John is I haven't met any other Nobel laureates, so I cannot generalize. But John is a very, I think, special person indeed. He's extremely supportive, extremely humble. He never calls his students as students. He always refers to us as colleagues. And it's a lab that he really let you, run with your own ideas and own interests. That's why in his lab, I studied regeneration, in which he had no particular interest in, but he was always happy to discuss what I'm thinking. And he would question you a lot about what is your question. That's very important for him. You have to crystallize your question. And then you have to think of the best experiment that will be giving you the clearest experimental result. Like that is going to really test your hypothesis. You are there to reject the hypothesis, not prove the hypothesis. So it wasn't a tough lab. If you are very independent, would be the right answer.
I mean, that's great training for grant writing, I guess. Crystallize your question and have solid plans.
Yeah, kind of.
So something else you worked on for a long time was stem cells. And again, this is something Emma does. And Emma's in the lab a lot. How did you find that during your PhD? I mean, it's generally long hours. How do you deal with that?
So before my PhD, I was working with stem cells a lot, with human ES cells or the mouse ES cells. And I think they have different advantages. Every system has a different advantage. Like I cannot do biochemistry that I can, in liver research, there's no biochemistry almost that you can do. But with stem cells, you can do such things. It is really hard, but at the same time, I have to say that when you go to in vivo, you realize how artificial is in vitro. I'm not saying this to undermine in vitro. I think there are still a lot of new information we can gather from in vitro research, which I am actually also initiating against in vitro research. But it's all up to the research question. If you are very excited about your research question, I think it doesn't matter how time-consuming the stem cell. I think it's fine. I don't know what would Emma think about it.
Yeah, what does Emma think about that?
I mean, I wouldn't go in on weekends that often if I didn't care about myself. If I care about them. I care about the experiments that are going on. But I do agree. I completely agree with you. I think you need in vitro and in vivo things. So a lot of people that I've spoken to are always like, iPSCs are the best because they're human and they're from human. But I'm like, but what about, how do you know how things act in vivo, in a group of cells, how they interact with each other? I think that's just as important. So I went from fly work to cell work. And now I'm like, maybe I'll try and tie the two. Maybe not. I don't know.
I understand that feeling, though.
Yeah.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.
So something else you did, which is also new for the show, is you went straight from your PhD into being a PI. That must be brave. It must be a big jump, because I think a lot of postdocs find that transition incredibly difficult. So I've no idea. Well, how did you feel doing that as a PhD student going from student straight into responsibility?
I mean, I'm very fortunate to have this position. I started my research group actually almost 4 months ago in the Institute of Technology Lausanne, also known as EPFL. And it's a special program for PhD students. Actually, you can apply while you are finishing your PhD to start your own independent research group. So I think it's maybe too early to comment on how hard it is. However, what I can say is I think there are certain parts nothing would prepare you for, let's say that way. I think there are certain suddenly there's a lot of admin work that you don't know, managerial work you don't know, didn't get proper training for. And at the same time, you are dealing with papers still and you have to do experiments. So your workload definitely goes completely out of the roof. But it's I so far enjoy it, to be honest. I am not feeling I'm lost, let's say.
That's where I wish I could be. I hate being a postdoc. It's just.
But I should mention that I didn't have a very regular PhD.
No. I have looked at the program you're in, and the website makes it look amazing. It looks like a really nice culture to be working in, just based on the website. But it looks like, there's a lot of activities and a lot of focus on things like mental well-being, on just doing good science in a happy place, which I think too often we don't necessarily get.
I think Lausanne is a very beautiful city. It's sunny, and it's, from lab in 10 minutes, you can get into lake and swim and come back to lab, which is new to me, for example. But also, I think people are extremely nice in PFL, and they are super, super supportive so far. And I also would like to mention one particular thing about our program, Elysir. All of us Elysir scholars, we are researchers who jump from PhD to this PI position. And every year, one or two people are being selected to this program. And we have a very nice group. We are all going through the same processes all together, and we are helping each other a lot. So I think they are really facilitating this transition, because they were in my situation a year ago, and they know how things can go in different directions. And I think there's a very nice support from Elysir group, in addition to school in general. So I have to shout out to them. I'm very, very happy to be a colleague.
That's something the EMBO PIs mention a lot as well. So EMBO, big European grant for new PIs. And on that, it's kind of like a semi-structured training platform where they meet up every year. And everyone I've spoken to who's gone through that route has said it's super supportive. And you have a network, which I think as a postdoc or a PhD student, that network is probably the most important thing to getting through science.
Absolutely.
So how much support do you, as a new PI, do you get are you mentored officially as part of that as well? So do you have someone who's been a PI for a very, very long time sort of walking you through the process as well?
Yep, exactly. Every scholar has institutional mentors. Like everyone had like three mentors. But genuinely, like people are really supportive. Like even if they are not your mentors, they know that you jumped from the PhD to the PI position. And they know that, you know, you may not know certain things. So a lot of people are trying to help us. And I mean, the EPFL is a very diverse institute. Like there are a lot of research topics. Like it's an engineering school primarily known for, but there are a lot of developmental biologists who are bridging engineering with developmental biology. And they want more diversity in the school. In that sense, like me getting into EPFL is actually, they're also excited about my research. That's why they're also helping.
And so I'm kind of on the fence as to whether people should go PhD, PI, or you should be forced to do a postdoc. I don't think anyone should be forced to do a postdoc. But is this a system you think should be rolled out more widely? Because it's not common for PhD students to skip that step. So is this something we should be looking at more, or should we maybe hold off?
I think US like has been benefiting from it for a very long time. Like a lot of different institutes in the US have such like similar fellowship programs in Whitehead Institute or Stanford, Harvard, but they all have similar programs. And the labs that are formed through such programs are not to be generally very, very successful in their later careers. I mean, we have data only from them enough to comment on. Like, I think Europe, we don't have such programs that commonly. EPFL is pushing for it now. And I am thinking it will spread more. Because if there's a very enthusiastic PhD student who has already shown that they're independent and take care of different research directions during their limited PhD period, I think becoming a PI may not shake them that much.
So it is something we don't see very much in Europe, but I think you're right. We are going to see it rolled out a bit more. The Wellcome Trust in the UK, for example, their new grant rejig has shifted things, so there's now a quite a tight limit on who can apply for the early career grant, so that's kind of pushing it more towards the PhD student than the postdoc. In fact, I don't think there'll be many postdocs who can apply within the time frame. So one of the questions I did have, though, is, so you said that, you know, these people often go on to be very successful, and they generally come, looking at the programs I'm aware of, they generally come from sort of quite big successful labs anyway, but how do you judge somebody's success that early on? I think that's why I'm on the fence. I think you need to, because PhD programs, you can have some where you are very, very independent, but you can also have some where your hand is held throughout the whole thing, and actually you haven't really, some people might argue with me, but you haven't really done anything. So how do you think that's quite a difficult thing to judge at any stage, but how do you show that at that stage?
It's a very tough question, right? I mean, for my case at least, and for my peers in the Elizabeth program, like the common thing I may be able to say is that, I mean, we all had some sort of like independent research line during our PhD. We were not just doing what our lab is doing. And some of us, including me, we initiated completely new research topic that is not familiar with the lab. And if you manage to produce like results that are relevant for the field in that short time period, I think it shows that you have an understanding about the field, what is missing, what's going on, and you benefit from the time that you have and money you have, the best possible outcome. Like, you know, you are generating new data and then you are trying to publish it in that short time period. So, I mean, I'm not saying the publishing part is necessarily the success rate here, but it's just you are managing projects and completing them in a given time. They may not necessarily need to turn into publication, but if it is going somewhere, I think it's a sign that you are successful.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was hoping you would say, because I think that's really good advice for PhDs and postdocs, but particularly those in the PhD, when you have that time to make mistakes and to kind of play around a little bit. I think it is really good if you can do something a bit independent during that time.
Yeah.
So, should have done this in a different order now I've thought about it. But coming back to the paper we're talking about, this paper started life off as a preprint. Was it your choice to preprint this work?
Yep.
And why did you choose to do that?
So first of all, like it was all the authors were okay with it, but my colleague, like my co-first author Tom and I, we were really about this to put on like by archive. And there were like many different reasons. One of them was we were confident with the research, we were happy with it, and we both had a timeline that we had to finish on time. And we wanted to get feedback, and we were in lockdown. So, you know, like there was not enough time to wrap up everything and get feedback on time with the publication process. We knew it's going to take ages. So we just wanted to hear what other people are thinking, and they can maybe give us feedback so we can do all these experiments and include, and maybe publication process would go faster. That was our opinion and hope. And it somehow worked, somehow didn't work. But I'm still very, very happy that I put it in BioArchive, because like since we put it there, like a lot of people contacted me, my PIs, my colleagues, and I have new collaborators in my new position through that paper. And if I would have waited this paper to be published in a peer-reviewed journal, none of them would have been, you know, happening. So it really accelerated science, and I met really, really amazing people through that paper.
So you said in your Twitter thread you did with this that you had it showed you the sort of dysfunctional side of peer review.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
I think the peer review can be one of the best things that can happen to your papers. Like, I mean, I had like papers like where you see the reviewer really engage with the manuscript, try to understand it, try to comment on the parts that can really advance science. Like, irrespective of who you are submitting the paper, they just want the best of science. And I think majority of the people are like that. They really want the best for science, and they are pushing paper to become better. And when this happens, I am super excited, because I feel like I have a new anonymous ally who's helping me to try nature, like, you know, uncovering something real. But there's also the backside of our peer review system. Like, you may encounter really not so good reviewers who are just, you know, they don't bother reviewing your paper. They just write 4 sentences and reject your paper without giving you any reason. And then you're in a limbo. What are you going to do? Like, you don't even know what you should be improving. And then you're left alone. And this, like, unpredictability of what kind of reviewer you will get, it's a gambling almost. That's how I feel now. And, you are eventually influencing people's careers at the line at the same time, which is not nice. So, and for what is the question? Like, really, like, this paper is already in BioArchive. People already seen it. It just doesn't make sense to me. So, I had really mixed feelings about peer review, but I don't like the part where it's, like, not objective and not reliable system.
So, one of the things I've done it's under review now, it's been on BioArchive for a few months now, is we looked at preprints and their published versions, and we compared how they changed. They don't really. Something like, I think it was 80% don't change, depending on the field. So, I mean, looking at your sort of conclusions, your conclusions between preprint and paper didn't change. Your main message is still there. What did change? What was improved by peer review?
I mean, we changed the paper so significantly, I would say, because of journal formats, at least. Like, the first journal we sent, they wanted a shorter format. And development, we have a very big room to discuss what is our perspective, what are the limitations. So discussion expanded massively, I can tell you that, maybe tenfold. But other than that, the work, the experiment-wise, I think we may have only 2 new data. Like, you know, it's nothing significant or serious.
Mm. Yeah, well, this is what we were trying to get at with that work, is we're trying to kind of get people to think about whether or not those 2 extra experiments are worth the time and the money.
Absolutely not.
You know, so how could we change the system then? Because I guess preprints are one way of going about it, but like you said, peer review does very much have a place, and it's needed for a lot of reasons, actually, but it doesn't work in its current form. So what would you do differently if you were to be put in charge?
I have been thinking about this for a while, and I don't know is the realistic answer. I think, to be completely frank, I don't think peer review system will be fixed. I really don't think that. There will be grinches everywhere. Like, that's human nature. I think that. But I am very, very optimistic about preprinting servers, because when the work is there and people are recognizing it, that's done, right? Like, I know a lot of people who found faculty positions with their BioArchive papers. They don't need to wait to publish their paper. And I'm not talking about schools that are, you know, random schools all around. Like, I am talking about good institutes. They acknowledge these papers. I have a feeling like previous generations, they suffered from all this impact factor and the other problems with peer review enough, and they don't want next generations to feel the same way. I think there's a very like strong force from the seniors who are actually trying to fix the system by creating alternatives and acknowledging the whole open science initiatives. I feel the same is being done in EPFL, which is giving me a lot of hope. And I like when I was at Cambridge, I was seeing the Cambridge is also in the same line. I think the change is happening.
It is, yeah. I mean, we're seeing grant bodies now taking preprints on board, and I know quite a lot of people who've got their position because they had preprints, so they could show they were productive.
Yeah.
Whereas they wouldn't have had them otherwise, waiting for people. I think that might be the end of my questions. All right. Well, thank you so much. That was super interesting.
Well, thank you a lot, Danny, Emma, and John, for inviting me. And I am like hoping this preprints in Martian would become more larger, and you would be like influencing a lot of different people in different places. Thank you a lot.
Me too.
I look forward to hearing more podcasts.
All right. Well, good luck being a new PI.
Yeah, very exciting.
Thank you. And good luck to you all, Dan.
Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.